How y'all doing tonight? My name's John. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. It's good to be here tonight. I'm a little nervous. I grew up in Corpus Christi in a family of eight, and three brothers, two sisters. And I remember from the youngest age, I remember that I knew something wasn't right with me, or I could say something was wrong with me. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that if you looked at me, you could see it, you know. And I knew what it felt like. It didn't feel good, and it was a long time before I learned that what that was shame and low self-esteem. I was raised in a family with a rageaholic father, if you will, and a shaming mother. And so I think that really somehow ties in to how my story unfolds after that. I was in trouble at an early age. From the time I was a little boy, I was a thief. And what that is about, what that looks like is I thought that something outside of me was going to make me whole or make me feel better. Somewhere I got that notion that what would fill me up or complete me was something out there. I didn't know about anything in here other than stuff didn't feel good. So I got in a lot of trouble as a kid. By the time I was in elementary school, I was already doing burglaries. Junior high, same thing. And I remember going back to elementary school, they brought this little, now you got to keep in mind this was the 60s. They brought this little drug awareness thing in and showed us a lot of really intense pictures of people's arms rotting off from shooting up heroin and stuff. And I remember walking home in the sixth grade with my friend Mitch, and I said to him, I would never do drugs. And about two steps later, I said, but if I did anything, I'd smoke a little pot. And that was kind of a that was kind of a little peek into the future there. And that's kind of how it started out for me. The next year, I was in, back when they had junior high, it's middle school now, right? Is that how it works? Yeah, you can tell I don't have kids. In the seventh grade, I started smoking weed. And it was now, you know, coming into the 70s, late 60s, and long hair. And overnight, from just smoking a little weed after school one day, overnight I had this new set of friends. I say new set. I really didn't have any friends. I had just a couple friends. And all of a sudden I was like welcomed in this fraternity, if you will, and it felt good, you know. And that was the start of, I was going to get my hands on anything I could get my hands on and to change how I felt. Did I walk up here with the water? Because I need it already. thanks, Chris. I'm starting to calm down a little bit, but I am nervous. Where was I? Anybody listen? Yeah, smoking weed. So, I mean, I started doing just anything that was available, LSD and mescaline, mushrooms. And I wasn't real keen on drinking. I mean, I had, my body really rebelled against that. You know, I remember I'd be with my friends and we'd be drinking beer, and when they weren't looking, I'd pour it out because my body didn't want it, you know, and I'd get sick if I drank. But I fought through that like any good young alcoholic, and it became like my love, you know. For a long time, drinking beer was it. And straight out of high school, I went into the oil field. A lot of drugs there back in the 70s, and the oil field was booming, and I fell in love with meth. It was the real deal back then, and I fell in love with the needle is what I really fell in love with. And so, you know, I could do some speed and I can drink all I want and never get drunk. The first time that I did some meth, I all of a sudden was like in love with the world. All of a sudden I was, I felt like I was who I really was. I know y'all know what I'm talking about. I don't want to like get into all that a lot, but it was life change. It was a game changer for me because I knew that that was what I was going to do. And I did a lot of dope when I could afford it. My bottom was blowing my paycheck back in, okay? You know, in my early 20s, late teens, my bottom would be, besides going to jail for all kinds of burglars and stuff, I got in a lot of trouble as a kid. Got sent away, backing up. I got sent away as a juvenile a couple times. My bottom basically would be that I would blow my paycheck and then I'd, you know, have remorse and hangovers and I'd go back to work in the oil field and I'd just do it over and over again. In late 79, I got arrested in Fayette County, Smithfield area. I was in a stolen pickup, prohibited weapon, drug charges. It was like an ounce of weed. It was a little more of a big deal back then, but I was already on probation for burglary, and they transported me back to Nueces County. And I was sitting in the Nueces County jail, and I knew I was going to prison for the first time. And to be honest with you, I was scared. It was back when the prison system was really rocking and rolling. There was they had just flipped over where the inmates weren't running anymore, and you could pick up a newspaper any day of the week and read about X number of inmates stabbed on so and so unit. And I knew it was going to be intense, I knew I was going to prison. And so I was sitting in this kind of a holding tank in the Nueces County Jail, and I tell this story for a reason you understand later. I had this, Christians came in there and started talking to us, and everybody in the place just stopped what they're doing and started listening to these guys because they were spirit-filled. And they said, you know, you don't have to live like this anymore. There's another way of living. And they kind of had my attention, you know. I had been raised in a church, but it meant nothing to me. Almost all my life, until I was of age, I'd gone to church because I had to, and I kind of hated it, to be honest. Anyway, they had invited us to say a sinner's prayer and ask Jesus in our heart. And I did that, you know, and I felt something after that. I'm not going to turn that into a long story, but I knew that something had happened to me when I said that prayer. And the interesting thing is that I ended up not going to prison. They reinstated my probation and let me walk out just paying a fine for the weed up in Fayette County. They just wanted some money from me. And I got out, and I knew I'd had some kind of experience in there that meant something, but I didn't know what to do with that. And I kind of tried to go to church a little bit and felt like a fish out of water. Felt real uncomfortable, in fact. And so I went back to doing dope, you know. What are you going to do? And it wasn't long after that my parents, trying to rescue my little brother from drugs, had got him into Palmer Drug Abuse Program. Anybody heard of that, Palmer Drug Abuse Program? Yeah. PADAP, we called it. And that was my entry into recovery right there. In 1980, I was 22 years old. You know, I was trying to stay sober, working out in the oil field. My parents invited me to come home, and I started going to PADAP with my little brother, you know. And that's when I first got a sponsor, started trying to work these steps. You know, they're basically AA steps. But I came into the room, and I looked at these, you know, they had the steps up on the wall. They're worded a little bit differently, not much. And I read through them, and I kind of felt like, you know, that's some good stuff there, you know. But I quickly read, you know, 12, haven't had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. Well, I thought I already had a spiritual awakening, man. I had, like, asked Jesus into my heart in the county jail, and the cell door had opened, and I'd got out. You know, I'd had my spiritual awakening. you know, had nothing to do with these steps, but I'd had an awakening. And, I say it, I laugh, but that's true because here's what happened. I think that I worked the steps to the best of my ability at that time. But I got it. But I thought, I didn't think I really needed them. It was just something that was like useful. And I wanted to hang out with these people. They were sober and I was starting to have a life, and it was nice. And I wouldn't get drunk. I wasn't shooting dope anymore. I really didn't understand my character defects, for one. I was clueless about humility. I had if you could take this meter that read humility and put it on me, it would be like negative, or zero. I had no humility and didn't even know it. I didn't know, I don't know how I didn't know, but I didn't know that I was extremely self-centered. I mean, I look back at some of the things I did in recovery, and it's almost painful to look back at that. That was a long time ago. So, I hung out and put out for a number of years. I had a couple relapses, bounced right back, came right back in the door pretty much. Tried working in the oil field some more. That didn't work for me. There was a lot of dope back in the day in the oil field. A lot of hard living. And so I got involved with this woman in the program, and it was actually the first woman that I'd ever loved, my first real relationship, And the problem was because I wasn't really doing this deal, and I didn't know I wasn't doing the deal. Half time I didn't have a sponsor, didn't think I needed one. So I was clueless about how to have an intimate relationship with someone. Clueless. My parents, I never once saw my parents have an argument. I never heard them raise their voice my entire life, that's bizarre. I mean, that has to be somehow on some level dysfunctional, that you don't even have an argument in front of your children. So when I would get angry with this chick, I didn't know what to do with that. That would be it. I'm done. I get mad. I pack my shit. I leave. And after about the fourth or fifth time, she's got another boyfriend. Maybe this guy will stay. I don't know. So what would happen, I'd miss her terribly because I loved her. And I'd go back to her. I'd forget why I left, and everything be great for a while, all that makeup sex and all that, it was wonderful, life's good again, and then something would crop up and I'm done again, and that's kind of how that went. So, but the last time she found someone else, and it wasn't going back to her, and now what am I going to do with this pain? She can't fix it. I can't get back there and get it fixed. And so the pain got so bad that I went to a pawn shop. Now get this. I'm on probation, right? If you're a convicted felon, you're not supposed to buy a gun, right? Or have one. Anybody knows that, right? So I'm nervous about going to this pawn shop to get this gun that I'm going to use to put a hole in my head. I mean, does that make sense? Why are you worried? This is welcome to John's world here. So I go in there, and I'm looking around, look at these pistols, and I see this Bulldog 44 revolver. If you know anything about a Charter Arms Bulldog, the cylinders are they hold big bullets. And I buy this pistol. I fill it with hollow points. Why do you fill it? I don't know, but I filled it. I bought a whole, they sell by the box. And I'm laughing, but I sincerely intended, I thought, to check out, I didn't know what else. I didn't have these steps to deal with this pain. I wasn't doing this deal, I didn't know that was the problem. I didn't know there was a solution. This was like a hole card that I was going to play. And I remember I was sitting on a park bench. This was in the mid-80s by now, I probably had 6 years clean and sober, close to it. And And I cocked this pistol. I had it in my mouth, and I was thinking about my family. You know what? I knew it was going to devastate them. You know, but I knew this pain didn't seem to be going away. I couldn't see an out. And then somehow I had the presence of mind to realize that I didn't really want to kill myself. I just wanted the pain to end. You know, and so I thought, well, let's just wait another day, you know, and maybe it'll go away. Maybe something will fall on my head, you know. Maybe I'll call the right person. You know, I don't know what I've thought, but somehow it went from that to reverting back to something outside of me is going to fix me. And I decided I was going to take that pistol and start doing robberies, and that money was going to be the answer for me. You know, because I had done that almost my entire life. I'd gone looking outside of myself to feel what was missing here. And so that's what I did. I started doing armed robberies in Corpus. And how am I doing on time, brother? I got to what? Okay. So Corpus is not a real big town, okay? It's not a little bitty town. It's a little city is what it is. So I go to an HEB with this pistol, broad daylight, summertime, I got a coat on, sunglasses, hat, totally, that's my disguise. And I walk in, I walk in there and I'm really nervous about doing this, and so I'm standing in line. You know, back then a lot of people would line up and cash their checks. I don't know if it works like that anymore. And I'm standing in line like I'm going to cash a check, because truth is, I'm scared to death just to go up there and rob this office, you know. And as I'm standing in line, this woman from Narcotics Anonymous, because by then I had gotten involved with NA and Corpus Christi, walks in, and I don't know if she sees me or not, but I see her, and I'm like, you know, I can't do this now, so I leave, right? I come back the next Friday, because Friday's when everybody's cashing their checks. And don't get any ideas, guys. All right. And I come back here again, same thing, coat, hat, glasses. And this another woman from Narcotics Anonymous comes in with her little HEB uniform on. She works there. I'm like, oh, crap. She's coming right at me, you know. I've got, again, that big old bulldog, right, and I'm trying to, like, hug her where she can't feel it. And she's looking at me all weird. I'm not making this up. It's a true story. So here's my humility, and this is how much I was seeking God in my life. I walked out of the store, and I literally, like this, to God said, get the F out of my life, except I didn't say F, because I knew that he had sent both those people. I knew it wasn't coincidence. I knew that he was trying. He was giving me an opportunity for a U-turn. How fortunate we are that God gives us U-turns, that he allows them. And here's what I did. I just went to another HEB right then and robbed it. And it was the start of like this, you know, I had gone from living to paycheck at that time in my life. I was a maintenance supervisor out on the island and barely making ends meet all the time. And now I had all this instant money, and that became in itself an addiction to me. The power that I felt from making people do what I wanted them to do, making someone fear for their life, open the safe, you know, all that, the money, not having to work, doing as much dope as I wanted. And I got real sick real quick. I started doing the robberies in other cities, so you know, you don't do it in your backyard. I started traveling around to Houston, San Antonio, Austin, doing armed robberies. I became a serial armed robber. And then until I got caught, you know, and I went to prison in 88, 89. It was back in revolving door days, so I did like 18 months on a 15-year sentence, 9 in county, 9 in the system. Got out. The whole time I was in there, I was thinking about how to not get caught next time. You know, I was thinking about drugs. The demon had me, and I got out and went to some meetings, tried going to NA. I wasn't ready. Within a year, I was I got caught in a armed robbery here in Austin, and by this time I was using a sawed-off shotgun because that commanded a lot more respect, and it was less likely that someone would try to get cute with me, you know, or be a hero. And so I had these hole cards, suicide, and if things got too bad, I can check out. That's a hole card. Here was a hole card. Our disease will give us these hole cards to get us to do stuff. Here was another one, that if it went down again, I wasn't going back to prison, that I would either take myself out, suicide, or that I would kill a cop to get away. So I came out of the store packing, and they were everywhere. Somebody had seen me pull this shotgun out of the car. They were on a balcony, and I was parked in some apartments. They'd seen me pull the shotgun out of the trunk of my car and call police. So they were on the way by the time I walked all the way across this park lot to go in there and rob. They were already on their way. When I came out, I could hear them coming from everywhere. It was intense. So I tried to sneak back the back way, but there was one cop at the corner of the store. And he told me to stop, and I didn't know if he was Austin PD or if he was security guard. I needed to know what he had, and so I was trying to get closer to him to see if he had a gun. And at that point, he knew I had something under my coat, and he started popping caps at me, and I went down like he hid me behind some shrubs. He shot at me three or four times from here to that clock and missed. And it's a weird feeling if you've ever been shot at. The percussion is. It's just an intense feeling. And so I went down like he hit me, and I was waiting. I had some light, and I could see the corner of the store. He couldn't see me, and he stuck his head out. And then he came out all the way out, and I had him dead to rights. And it was a kind of a moment of truth for me, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't take him out. I mean, I knew that he was just a man doing his job, you know, and I was the one in the wrong. And so... So I jumped up, made him go back behind the building, and I tried to run back to my car, but they were everywhere, you know. And so there I was, already on parole for robbery, you know. I was dead, man, you know. And I had said I would check out. I couldn't do it again. I couldn't turn that shotgun on me. And so I needed those whole cards to be played. I needed those to be, like, out of my belief system, you know. And so I ended up getting a 30-year sentence. I did 9 years and some change on that. Got out in 01. My family stayed with me. God bless them. They sent me a little money, which was a big deal for all those years. They came and visited me as much as they could, a lot, actually. My mother passed away while I was in there. My dad opened up his home to me, and that's where I paroled to. And while I was in there, I decided to try to embrace Christianity. I did whatever I could to better myself. I tried, you know. I knew that one day I was going to get out. I didn't know what would be. I didn't know how many set-offs I'd get. I only got one, which is in itself a miracle. I got out and found a home church, found a home. I don't know if I found a home group, but I've got a sponsor. That's really important. I got a sponsor this time. He started taking me through the steps, and life got real good real quick. You know, I got a good job. I started in no time at all. I started my own business. I was making more money than I ever thought I'd make. And then I got in this long distance relationship. With an ex-girlfriend here in Austin, and I knew when I did that, this is real important, guys. I knew when I did that I was out of God's will. I knew it in my heart. I had all these red flags that I ignored because for lust, you know. And so I ended up moving my business to Austin. She had two kids in school. It was a no-brainer. who needed to move, right? And that was in late 04. By Thanksgiving 05, I was in full relapse. Because what happened was when I came here, I didn't find another sponsor. I didn't really find a meeting or a home group. I didn't find a home church. That's real important to me, too, in my recovery. And I don't even remember why it seemed like a good idea to start shooting dope again. I couldn't even tell you what the problem was. You know, it didn't take much. So meth had changed. You know, it wasn't the meth that I knew. Great disappointment for me. You know, coke was easy to find, you know. I didn't like the crap, right? But I liked the rush, and so I started doing it. And my girlfriend knew something was wrong after a while. You know, I was doing it every day, you know. You know, finally she was, like, getting calls from my employees. I had grown the company, had, like, 15, 20 employees, and she got a call from them that, like, I wasn't coming in. So she goes to my house, try not to picture this. I'm bare ass naked, laying on potato chips, you know, just passed out from being up for 4 or 5 days, you know, watching pornography. And I leap up naked, looking around to see what I left laying out. And she thought I was on pills, bless her heart. So she took me to a meeting. You know, she was trying, you know. She was trying to rescue me. And I tried doing the IOP a little bit. Or it was just some counseling, rather. That didn't work out. I promised her that. It was not long after that that she did an intervention. She called two of my siblings, and they came and they did an intervention on me in my house, and I agreed I needed to go into treatment. I knew by that time cocaine had got a hold of me like I never imagined something would, you know. I didn't know that it could be like that. In the early 80s, when people would come in to PADAP, you know, I'd done some dope, yeah, and I had drank a lot, and I'd done this and that, but I really didn't know nothing about addiction. You know, when people were struggling, I had no compassion for them, zero. Like, dude, either you want to be sober or you don't. Because for some reason, because I guess I wasn't that deep in my disease, it wasn't that hard for me to get sober and stay sober, you know? So all these years later, there I am. I can't keep a needle out of my arm. I can't, to save my life, I can't stop doing dope. So I picked Austin Recovery to go to. I self-paid. It was a lot different then. That was in 2007. I got out. I got a sponsor, a really good sponsor. He spent a lot of time with me, taking me through the steps. He spent like a day and a half with me on my fifth step, which really touched my heart. He spent like the weekend with me, you know. And, you know, I felt like I was all in. You know, I knew I was sick. I knew that I needed help. But when it came to the men's, he took me to the steps quick, you know, and I believe in that. And I told him about all these financial men's, because by then I had like just ran that business to the ground. You know, I probably had about $250,000 debt, you know, adding everything up, and it was like freaking me out, you know. And I told him, I said, like, I'm not trying to hear this financial men stuff, brother. And he said, John, I don't think you can stay sober if you don't make these amends. And I'm like, come on, man. I balked. Some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. See. And that was it. I believe that's why I didn't make it that time, because I balked at that step, you know. And it was not long after that I was having a bunch of thoughts about using, and I called my sponsor. He had slept in. He was all sleepy, and I called him to tell him that I wanted to use. And then when he got on the phone, and I just kind of like hung up, and I went and scored. You know, I think that if I'd have trusted him enough about that step, about the men's, I think if I trusted him, that I would have stayed sober, you know. So I went through a lot more pain. You know, I relapsed, got sicker, you know, and, but keep in mind I'm on parole for all this. I went into treatment again here in probably late 2008. And this time, you know, I did it kind of like because I had promised my chick, you know, I'd promised Paige that if I didn't stay sober, I'd go back in treatment. And so when I came in this time, I was like, I didn't really want to be here. It was totally different than the first time. I didn't really want to be here. You know, they were wearing me out with all these groups. And I even had snuck a cell phone in. I was calling her. I would go walking way out here in the woods and call her and you know, and letting other people use my phone. I just, you know, it was a different picture, you know. And parole knew that I was in treatment. And 2 days after I got out, the "you ate me" eye is already dirty, right? 2 days. And she's like, "You knew we were going to test you?" I knew you were. I just, you know. And so I'm not sure why this woman stuck with me. Codependency comes to mind. She hates that word. She's my ex-girlfriend, understandably by now, but she don't use that word in her presence. I started doing some IOPs because by now I'm pretty much broke. I can't afford another treatment center. And I'm doing I did a couple IOPs and I really was trying to get back. I picked up all kinds of chips, you know, 30 days here. If I got a 90, that was pretty exciting, you know. And one time I was like, she had told me that she wasn't going to have sex with me again until I got 6 months, right? So I had like this 6 months. You know, I'll do that for sex. I'll go 6 months. And I remember when I hit 6 months, she's like, "Nothing's changed about you. No, you know, we're not having sex." I'm like, "What? We had an agreement, you know." She said, "There's nothing different about you, you know." And I remember I was going to a Cocaine Anonymous to pick up my 6 month chip, right? And I was pissed, you know. But I was going to get my chip. That was my consolation prize, right? And I looked at my watch. I was almost there. Looked at my watch. I was 15 minutes late. And with no defense, I went to the dope house. With no defense, I was on the phone. You know, I tried begging them not to call me anymore over that period of time when I was trying to clean it. I went through 3 different phone numbers, getting rid of my phone. Anybody ever done that? Got rid of your phone so you wouldn't call? Yeah. I even would go back to my T-Mobile bill and look at the ones where there was really weird, like, "Oh, I called this guy 20 times in 10 minutes. That's got to be him, you know, right?" And I couldn't leave it alone. And I would leave town. I'd go home to Corpus Christi and come back. And when it got to where I was at coming up on the flyover, whether I would go east or west, Ben White, I didn't know until I turned east or west what I was going to do, you know. Or sometimes I think, well, if I got on the phone with somebody and told them I was wanting to use, I'd go left, I'd go home. But that part of me that wanted to get high wouldn't even let me get on the phone. You know, I know y'all, a lot of y'all know what I'm talking about. You know, I had reached a point where there was no human power that was going to relieve me of this. You know, I even tried, I went like almost 30 years without drinking. You know, I would just shoot dope in my relapses, right? And at the end, I thought maybe if I drank, you know, maybe I would like quit shooting dope and then I could just deal with drinking, you know, and then just get sober from drinking. And I'm glad I did that because there was this little bit of doubt about me being an alcoholic. Hell, I went 30 years without it, you know. But in that couple of years at the end of my relapse, I was drinking alcoholically. So I put that to rest. I'm really grateful for that. When it comes to alcohol, or alcoholism. I got a lot of yets. Never got a DWI. Never killed anyone drinking, you know, although I almost did, you know. So anyway, by now, my girlfriend is, at the time, she's in law school, 1L at Thurgood Marshall in Houston, trying to keep me alive and trying to go through law school. And I made another agreement with her that if I didn't stay clean by a certain date, I would turn myself into parole, and they would send me to Safe P. Anybody ever been to Safe P? Yeah. I'd heard all the good about it from my girlfriend. I'd heard all a bunch of bad about it from anyone that ever went, you know, right? And who goes into parole and says, I want to go to Safe P?
No one.
I did. I did. And so that time came, and I actually went 2 days early because I knew I couldn't quit doing dope. And I was actually, I don't know if you've ever been to that South office. They got restrooms up the stairs, and it's like bar room doors that swing open. That's your doors, the bathroom. I'm in there shooting dope, and I can hear my parole officer call my name. I'm like, I ain't done yet, you know. That's how sick I was, you know. And I wound up spending 6 months at ISF, and they ran out. They had a time period where they had to send me to Safe P. And by the end, I was like praying that I wouldn't go. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of there so I could go do dope. And that's what I did. I went to Houston, got my dogs out of the pound. They had ended up in the pound in Houston. I had like a $1,000 pound bill I had to pay to get my dogs out of jail. And then I scored dope on the way home, and that was it, you know. And so this went on and on. I could not get clean. I could not get clean. And then, but I kept trying. Every once in a while, I would my home group is not a glum lot in Dripping Springs. I'd show up at that meeting. I'd there, Bolden, you know, just different places. I'd show up. I'd drag in there, ashamed, you know. I couldn't talk in meetings anymore. I couldn't even pray anymore. Because, you know, I felt like this. You know, God had given me so many chances at recovery, you know, and each time, like, just over nothing, I just thrown it away, you know. And then I'd try again. I'd ask him for help. I'd ask people to pray for me. I'd come close, and then I'd just throw it away like it was nothing. And so I was ashamed to even ask him anymore. I didn't feel worthy. I know y'all know what it feels like to not feel worthy. You know, that's like the core of that thing, you know. That's why we don't do the steps. Somewhere down there, we don't even think we're worthy of the effort. You know, it's a lie, but it's in there, you know. And so, I keep losing my thoughts. Sorry. Maybe the water will help. So this last time, I went picked. Here's how it ended. My girlfriend wasn't my girlfriend anymore, but we were still friends, and I invited her for a Super Bowl party, and I'd made a bunch of badass margaritas, and she showed up at halftime. I was already drunk, you know. I'm like, and pissed. I think it's really rude that she shows up at halftime at the Super Bowl. So, and then I don't think she's treating me right while she's there, you know. So I ended up here. The night ended with me like opening the gate, beating on the hood of her Jeep, telling her to get the F off my property, and I'm screaming this, and another neighbor's heard me. And I wake up the next morning, I'm like, oh, did I really, really? I really did that? And that was miraculously the last day that I drank. The Super Bowl, that Super Bowl about, what, 5.5 years ago was the last time I drank. But I didn't know that was going to be that. I called her. I was mortified. I apologized. Again, I went to a meeting that night in Dripping Springs. I picked up a white chip or a silver chip, a desire chip. And, you know, that's all I knew to do. You know, I knew that it worked. I had friends that got sober when I did in 1980 that had never relapsed, a couple of them. And so I knew it was the only thing. It's the only thing I knew, you know. But I didn't know, am I just Am I just taking a break? Is that what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a break and then, you know, go back after it? Or am I so sick? I was beginning to believe that I was so sick that God wasn't going to be able to pull me out of it this time. Anybody ever felt that? Like even God wasn't going to be able to fix it this time. You know, I'd gone too far. And so I just started going to meetings, you know, and I got a couple of temporary sponsors here and there. You know, I talked about how I felt. I fought the urge this time. And then when I decided that I really did want to stay sober, that I had a chance at it, that's when I got my sponsor that I already knew I wanted, you know. But I didn't want to ask him until I knew I was ready, you know. And he took me through his steps. And then when we came, guess what? He takes me through all his steps. We get to that ninth step, and I tell him the same song and dance. Johnny, man. Brother, I owe like at least $250,000. I can't pay that, dude. I'm not even interested in paying that. And he goes, look, brother, all you have to do is have willingness to be willing. Just, I want you to go home and pray about this and ask God to give you the willingness to be willing to work this step. And I said, I can do that. I can do that. And that's what I did. And guess what? The willingness started coming. You know, I didn't balk. By the help of my sponsor, I didn't balk on that step. And probably the biggest change this time is that I now tell on myself. It's huge. You know, I mean, it's like, it's huge. Every time I call my sponsor up, every time, he has never failed to hit a home run with me when I call him up with my ass on fire. You know, I call him up one time, Johnny, I got this new PO. I hadn't met him yet. He's a dick. And I'm going to have to go see him right now. And I was like ready to do battle with this PO I'd never met. And he said, well, you might be a dick, John, but that's none of your business. And you need to pull over right now. It's a true story. You need to pull over right now, pray for him, and ask God to come in your heart too. Don't drive any further until you do that. And I said, all right, I'll do that, Johnny. And he said, and here's another thing. You have to make amends to him. Make amends to him? You don't know what he said. All right. And so I did. I pulled over, prayed, made amends when I got there, and immediately everything changed. That was like an amazing experience to me about prayer. Like God really heard me when I asked him for help with that. You know, it blew me away. I tell him, I had it like, this is embarrassing, 2.5 years sober, I had to call my sponsor and told him I had been shoplifting from Home Depot. 2.5 years sober. Don't try this at home, guys. You know, if I hadn't told him myself, I wouldn't be standing here talking about being sober. You know, it's everything. It's my anger. It's my unloving thoughts. It's like every time I call him, he calls me on my stuff gently, and I trust him, and I do what he says. You know, that's probably the biggest deal for me today is that I trust another human being. You know, and really what I'm doing is I'm trusting God to work through that person. You know, that's how I have a new employer, you know, really mostly is that he speaks to me through y'all. You know, he speaks to me through y'all, and then I don't go to bed at night without reviewing my day. I won't do that. I'll get on my knees, and then I won't leave the house without getting on my knees again and, like, trying to get centered before I step out into this craziness, you know. And it's been different, you know. So if you're struggling, you know, if I don't care how many times it's been treatment, look, don't stop getting back in the saddle, you know. And I want to encourage you that this is the easier, softer way, these steps, you know. This is what's done it for me. It's not the church, you know. I tried to make that work. I love church, but it's the program Alcoholics Anonymous that has given me a life and saved my life. Thanks for letting me talk tonight.